Hello there, adventurers, and welcome to Wally DM. Today is the Golden Sturge podcast, and I have the distinct pleasure to be joined by three fellow YouTubers. I am very excited about today's podcast and looking forward to chatting with all three of them about all things YouTube and all things D&D. So I would like to introduce each one, starting with the guy above me in the top left square from Chicago and the Emmy Award-winning Bill Allen.
Hello, adventurers. Welcome. It is it's my pleasure to be here with my fellow gamers, and I'm looking forward to our casual conversations tonight as we embark on topics both provocative and informative. I just made that up, by the way. That's called improvised DMing right there. Just top of the head.
I love it. In the top right square from New Hampshire and the master of all things miniatures, we have Caleb from Blanco.
Hello. I'm so glad I get to use my normal voice. I normally do this fake voice for YouTube.
Hi. My name is Caleb, and I am from the Blanco channel. I talk about cheap miniatures and making D&D and other tabletop terrain from garbage. So that's my channel.
Oh, this is going to be great. All right. And then, third, from Nova Scotia, we have the professor of D&D monster history, Josiah, also known as Dungeon Dad.
What is going on, guys? That's me. I feel like I am, I don't know, I feel like that's a lot of laurels that you're placing upon me already. But yeah, no, I am Josiah, Dungeon Dad. I have a YouTube channel all about monsters and monster design in Dungeons & Dragons specifically. And sometimes we pull stuff from video games, but just about things that you want to sick on your players to make them have a good time.
Fantastic. And for those of you listening and or watching that don't know who I am Wally D, and I have a small YouTube channel that focuses on D&D traps, puzzles, and character creation videos. So let's go ahead and get started to the chat room. Just a real quick thing. I'm going to try to monitor it as best as I can. If there are some questions in the chat that we can get to, I will definitely try to do so. But please don't sad face if for some reason I am not able to get to those questions. Got a lot planned, so let's go ahead and jump into it. And we are going to focus on YouTube content creation. And our first question... Oh, wait, do you guys have D20s by any chance?
Shoot. I mean, I do.
Fantastic. If everybody has a D20, let's roll for initiative. All right. 18 for Bill.
I got a 14.
14 for Caleb.
I also rolled a 14. It was a higher dexterity.
Okay. Well, I'm a librarian class, so I'm not dex heavy. It's not my dumb stat. I would say you probably go first because you have the dad reflexes. Yeah. You know, if like a baby's falling over, a toddler's about to jump off a cliff, I would say you get to go first on that.
All right, fair enough.
I love the way this is sold. Oh, fantastic. All right. So Bill, you're going to kick this off for us. When did you start your channel and why did you become a YouTube content creator?
So I started my channel when Dwarven Forge came out with the City Builder set. I had taken a very long hiatus from D&D and had been playing a lot of other games. And I happened to hook up with some people in my neighborhood who had like a regular ongoing game. And one day one of the guys busts out dungeon tiles. And I'm marveling at these Dwarven Forge dungeon tiles. And I'm like, these are the coolest things I've ever seen. And they were like the first edition of the Dwarvenite. So he's like throwing them at a wall in a basement and they're not shattering like resin, you know, older kind of like plaster tiles would. So I was like, this is the greatest toy ever, and now I must get back all in into D&D. So, you know, some guys have midlife crises and they, you know, buy fast cars or they cheat on their wives. I spent $1,000 on Dwarven Forge, and it, I mean, it did almost cost me in my marriage, but you know, it was worth it. So, for whatever reason, I was one of the first people to get my fulfillment from the Kickstarter. And like people on the forums were like talking about it. And I'm like, dude, I have this stuff. Like I should do some unboxing videos. Nice. So I did. And they were very well received. But as you know, gamers might know, Dwarven Forge is kind of the cream of the crop. It's the premium and it costs a lot of money and not everybody can afford it. So I'm looking around on the webs for like Dwarven Forge knockoffs and like how to make your own terrain. And I stumble upon this quirky dude named DM Scotty. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, this guy's making, you know, stuff out of like recycling. Like, I'm not artistic in this way, but I got to try this because I can't afford this Dwarven Forge addiction. It was like cocaine. So I basically start experimenting. My first few projects sucked. I wanted to like quit and throw in the towel, but then I kept on going and I joined the Facebook group and I was very active for a period of time. And my channel, I started the channel just because I wanted to have a place on the web where I could put all of my crap that I was interested in. And I really didn't have like a theme or a marketing plan. You know, it wasn't a focus. It was just like, all right, music, food, D&D, terrain, and that's kind of how it started.
Nice. Very good. What about you there, Josiah?
Yeah, so I don't know. I got my start doing YouTube. I think I was just really wanted to do something on the internet. Like, I don't know, like everybody and their dog does. But I actually started by streaming Hearthstone like 4 years ago, because my friend of mine and I, we played all the time. He would come over and we would just play together like on our own laptops. Mm-hmm. And then we were like, we should stream this. Like, why not? So then it just turned into this thing where every Friday he would come over with like 2 bottles of homemade wine and we would play Hearthstone until 1 a.m. It was super fun, but no one cared. We didn't care that no one cared because that wasn't really why we were doing it. But right. It was a lot of fun. And then, unfortunately, he moved away. So I was like, well, I need to do something for myself. What interests do I have besides Hearthstone? It's like, I really like D&D. I don't know. So I just kind of watched a bunch of D&D content. I was like, yeah, I could do this. But what could I bring to the table that isn't already out there? And I spent a lot of my free time and still do just making monsters and converting old monsters and stuff. I was like, oh, I should do a channel about monsters. So that was just kind of how that started. And I mean, like everyone who does this, I was horrible at it at first, but you just got to get a little bit better every time you put out a video. And, you know, yeah, that was just kind of how things got started. And it just rolled into what it is now, I guess.
Nice. Yeah, I can definitely relate. I go back and watch like my first couple of videos to today. I'm just like, holy smokes, can I just do those over? But
you're ever having a day where you're like getting that imposter syndrome or you just feel bad about what you're making, you're like, oh, my recent video sucks, go back and watch a video from at least a year ago and you'll instantly be like, oh, yeah. I feel much better about where I'm at now. Yeah, totally.
Absolutely. What about you there, Caleb?
The year was 2006. Oh, Bill, come on. It wasn't that bad of a story. No, the year was 2006, and Blandco is actually the name of my fake production company for my college video stuff. So the channel was originally to host that stuff. So the vast majority of that content is just gone. And then I got into video game content,
okay,
where I made a lot of other people, a lot of content that I didn't really get credit for, because I was, you know, young and stupid and getting taken advantage of. So there's a little bit of the video game content still on my channel. And then I just kind of floundered around until I got really into D&D again when 5e started fully getting its legs. I was, you know, so then I just started doing content, and the sort of content I was interested in was because I had very little money back then, and I just wanted to focus on, you know, the best cheap miniature alternatives out there at the time. And I just continued to do stuff like that, and I started doing some reviews and just peppered in, you know, little video projects here and there. And now my channel is mostly about D&D stuff.
Nice. And I'm going to take for granted that all four of us are currently playing 5th edition. Is that correct going forward? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, among other games, primarily 5th edition. Okay.
All right. Fantastic. All right. Cool. Let's move on to question number 2. And we'll start with Josiah on this one. What keeps you making videos, and what are a few of the goals for your channel?
That's like such an intense question, but it's a good one. As far as what keeps making videos, I mean, the biggest thing is just like the community, because especially with the angle that I kind of take things from whenever I do a video, it's like a deep dive on a monster. I always do a stat block for that monster. So the whole thing being, oh, if you like this, here's the information, you go drop it in your game or whatever, right? The community response to that stuff is like awesome, because I'll post something and then a couple weeks later people will be like, oh, I used this monster and like someone died, or like this happened or this happened or this happened, and you're like, oh man, this is so cool, because you just kind of get to see the feedback and just that circumstance that you're creating by putting that stuff out in the world. So I don't know, I live for that stuff. Like I always encourage people, like, tell me what you do with this, or if it's like a really weird monster that's like you have to be running like a party of level 19 characters for this to even be relevant. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, I'll probably never use this, but then when someone tells me, like, use this as the big boss in my epic campaign, I'm like, how did that go? I genuinely want to know, because that kind of stuff is already so hard to balance anyways. But yeah, that's definitely my main reason, I guess, for continuing to do what I do.
I can definitely relate. I mean, that's like huge when you get feedback and be like, hey, I use this in my game, everybody loved it. It's very addicting. I mean, you know, you just want to, that just keeps you making, want to put more out there. Just feedback and comments and people interacting with you on your channel. I mean, it's huge for sure.
I don't think people even understand to the extent that they affect that kind of stuff, because like, once in a while, someone will send me something like miniatures, Ector miniatures, that kind of thing, just as like, hey, thanks for what you do. And someone, one of my awesome followers, he sent me a couple of miniatures that he had, and it included this like sticky note. I have it right here on my computer. It says, hey man, thanks for all the great content. And I just stick that on my computer, and I look at that like every day when I sit down to work, because it's like, I don't know, people do care. It's just weird when you have the internet and a screen between you, but yeah, I don't know, that kind of stuff like takes you farther than anything else, I feel.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. Bill comes in with glasses on. Caleb, we'll move on to you next.
You know, I'm just one of those people who just always kind of made video stuff. Even in high school, when I had absolutely almost zero access to cameras and stuff like that, I still, like, you know, used the school's video camera to do some video projects and stuff. So I would be making video project stuff, and it's just I'm motivated to try to, like, you know, just improve what I'm doing and try to make stuff that I would find entertaining. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've got a lot of really great viewers that give me a lot of good feedback. And, you know, I feel comfortable trying new stuff and continuing to try to just make better projects.
Yeah, very nice. What about you there, Bill?
Can you repeat the question?
Yes. what keeps you making videos? What are the goals of your channel?
Well, I have a very supportive community. Yeah. And I have 7 kids, so I need the money. No, I'm just kidding. I only have 2 kids. But I do need the money. And honestly, you know, I mean, the reality is that my channel was just kind of a like I said, like a place to put all my stuff. And I did have quite a few terrain making videos and tutorials and stuff. But things didn't really blow up until D&D with high school students started. And then once that happened, it was just, it's been a rocket ship. Like, I can barely keep up with everything. And I will echo the sentiments of everybody else in just saying that the fans, the patrons, all that stuff, like, that's what keeps us going. I have students lined up who want to play D&D, and I just don't have enough time. So, you know, at a certain point, I had to kind of give up control and say, you guys are going to start deciding. So I kind of put it on the students. They're really effectively casting directors, they're producers, they're the crew, you know, and I think the combined reward of having a really supportive community of subscribers and patrons, coupled with my students getting real opportunities to mix their mad video skills with gaming, is the only reward that I need to keep going. That's the fuel.
Nice. And I think I'll just finish that topic off by just pretty much echoing what everyone else has said. And for those of you listening out there, comments and sharing videos and interacting with YouTube creators is so important. If you like a channel, even if it's just a, hey, nice job type of a thing. I know from experience, just, you know, waking up in the morning and there'd be like, you know, a couple of YouTube messages, and then scrolling through and reading something like, hey, I used this, you know, your idea in a game of mine, it went fantastic, thank you very much. I mean, it makes your day. You know, it's just like, you know, I call into work, I start drinking right away, partying. No, I'm just kidding. It's like, woohoo. But yeah, so, definitely. Yeah.
So if you comment, you're directly leading to the unraveling of Wally's life. Just keep that in mind.
I haven't worked in 14 days.
Something that you mentioned, Caleb, as well, that I think is really important too, is that kind of this format allows you to experiment in a lot of ways. In like, there's not like a producer or someone telling you what you can and can't do. So being able to have that freedom and having a community that's like, yeah, we'll still watch it even if you do like some stupid weird ass intro or something, you're like, you know, so being able to experiment with that kind of stuff is, it's just fun.
Absolutely. All right. Let's see here. What else we got in the bucket here? Caleb, I do believe it's your time to go first. What do you enjoy most about content creation? And we might've already covered this. So, up to you.
Just the great feedback that I get from my fans, and then the insane feedback that I get from people that are just trying to like harass me, but they don't know how to do it. So they'll literally say stuff like, "Oh, you know, you must be a Critical Role fan because you really don't know much about D&D," and like, like, these are clearly grown men like trying to say something that's getting underneath my skin. And it's just the most bizarre thing. So, yeah, no, that's really fun. And my channel is just one of those channels that attracts a lot of people like that. I mean, I sometimes say stuff that people just don't agree with. Like, you know, people are very, I've had people that like just are subscribed to my channel, and literally they just sit there and they type harassing comments, like not knowing that I block them. So I check like 3 months later, and like literally they must have like just never figured out that I have them muted on the channel. So they're just still following my channel on YouTube, typing, and these people would type in comments on every single video. Basically, you know, you had the temerity to say something incorrect about D&D. So thus, you know, so, but yeah, no, I mean, that's just, you know, I'm kind of kidding. What do I enjoy most about content creation?
I apologize three times for that. You know, I apologize 3 times for all those comments I left, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you did have some good points. But I mean, I don't know. It's just a weird thing. Like, why, you know, I enjoy editing videos and creating stuff and just putting my ideas into some sort of thing. And that's, I would do that regardless. It's great that I have like this bizarre community that's kind of cropped up around my content. But I would still be doing it even if I didn't have any, you know, if I didn't have anything at all, I would still be making stuff.
Fantastic.
So I just don't know.
How about you, Bill?
Well, I mean, for me, the channel represents, you know, an opportunity to make content that I truly appreciate. So as a media teacher at the high school, I make content, all like videos, my living, literally. So it's not so much the opportunity to make video, because I make hundreds of videos every year, but it's the opportunity to make video with my students that really appeals to like my passions and my interests. And it's funny because as much as we produce, that's just a fraction, like a fraction. The gaming content's a fraction of what we do in the high school program. So I love the opportunity to mix what I've done since 1978 with games and what I've done since the early 80s with video, and be able to teach it to another generation of kids, both the video skills and the value of gaming. Because to me, gaming, I can't imagine a world without it. I started playing when I was 5 years old. So it's everything. I mean, it boosted my interest in so many different things. I mean, first and foremost, just like the love of learning about new things. You know, literacy, everything, man.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then Josiah.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. But yeah, no, just like, I feel like anyone who does this kind of thing, like you guys said, you just gotta do it to do it, because it's part of who you are and you just love doing it. 'Cause I don't think any of us would be doing what we do if we hated it. You know what I mean? Like, 'cause that's the thing, is I think the learning thing is a big aspect of it as well. Because I mean, when I started, I did audio engineering in school, so I did some of the sound thing. I was like, okay, cool, I get it. But when it came to video editing, I had never touched that before. So everything I did in Premiere was like completely self-taught by watching tutorials and stuff. And that was kind of the thing that made me want, every time I go to make a new video, I was like, okay, I can't wait to do this again. Now I know how to quickly cut things and put them together. How do we do some transitions? How do we do this? How do we do this? And I don't know, you just get to a point, like, you never stop learning. I don't think I've ever spoken to someone who's like, yeah, I've learned everything I need to know about this. I'm just done now. Like, you know? So I think that's a huge drive for sure when it comes to the actual creation of stuff, like videos especially.
Yeah, absolutely. And I pretty much same sentiment that the rest of you guys have. I'd probably be doing this regardless. I didn't share on the first question or whatever else, but I kind of just got into it after a 15-year layoff between D&D. I got into Pathfinder, and I had always liked putting puzzles in my game, and so I started watching a couple of names that were YouTubers that were out there. Was Dungeon Master Johnny and the Player's DM. I mean, I was like watching those guys all the time, and they had puzzle stuff, and I was like, well, shoot, I can do that. I can share my ideas. And so I just started doing that. And at that time in the beginning, I didn't think of subscribers or anything else like that. I just want to put ideas out there. And pretty much that's still my intent today, is still just to put ideas out there. And that's why sometimes I stray away from what my channel is supposed to be focused on to do a few other things, is because I just enjoy making content. So I might make some off the wall video that gets 90 views over its lifetime, but it's just something that I wanted to do. So put it out there. Let's see here. Question number four. Let's move back to Bill to lead us off here. How long have you been playing D&D or TTRPGs? What edition did you start with, and who or what pulled you into the hobby?
Okay, so I was 5 years old in 1978. My older brother started playing D&D with his friends in middle school, and he taught me how to play. I still have my first character. It's on an index card. Very simple, stripped down basic rules. And within a couple of years, there were other kids in the neighborhood playing. And I pretty much played role-playing games all my life. There was a period of time in the 90s where I got very heavily involved in White Wolf games and kind of stepped away from D&D and came back to discover third edition, then 3.5. We did play fourth edition for a couple months. And then we moved over to Pathfinder. That was fun. And then when Wizards launched the playtest, we played the playtest. D&D Next is what that was called, if you guys remember. And then fifth edition. So I played all the editions, but I want to note that I never played basic D&D or expert D&D. I played advanced D&D. At 5 years old, I started with advanced because I'm that kind of bad motherfucker.
I was going to say, I read it now and I still don't understand it. Those first edition modules, holy smokes, yeah. Man.
Yeah, no, and you know what? And I'm going to be honest with you guys. Now, some old school role-playing people might have a bone to pick with me, but if you want to step to me, I live in Chicago. Bring it. I'm just going to say this. The problem with beginning D&D is that you would play a dwarf or an elf, and they didn't have a class. That was just like, that's just what they were. And even at like 6 or 7 years old, after playing for a little bit, I was like, what the fuck were these people thinking? Like, why can't a dwarf be a wizard or an elf be a cleric? I was like, this is stupid. And I, you know, that's why I stuck with AD&D. I never really had an interest in basic, you know? So, I mean, that's where I started, and it's been here all along. I still have my player's handbook, my DM's guide, the original Deities and Demigods with the mythos in it.
Nice.
That's how. all the rest of the old books I had, I sold for drug money in the 90s. And
well spent.
Common
yeah, but I mean, but you know, basically, I mean, you know, no matter what edition D&D is, if you play D&D, you could pick up any edition and have fun. And I will say this. The people who get hung up on rule sets, this isn't going to be popular either because everybody's like, well, play how you want and have fun. If your whole thing is about rule sets, then I'm sorry, but you're playing the game wrong. Like, it's not about the rules, man. It's about sitting around a table with a bunch of people and playing a game. It doesn't matter what the rule sets are. I could run a D&D game for all of you right now and have it only be based on flipping a coin, and it'll be the best fucking game you've ever played. That's it. I'm done.
Drops the mic. Oh, who has to follow that? Josiah.
Sweet, yeah. I couldn't agree more, by the way, about your sentiment when it comes to rule sets, but that aside, so in the 90s, some guy bought a bunch of drugs from my uncle and gave him all his D&D books, which is how we got them. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know. I just was vaguely aware D&D existed, like, as a teenager, but I didn't know anyone who was playing. I wasn't exposed to it at all. Believe it or not, in Nova Scotia, which is a pretty rural province, we don't have a huge tabletop scene. That has changed a lot in the past couple of years, as it has everywhere with 5th edition and tabletops becoming very popular and stuff. But yeah, no, so that just, I don't know, there wasn't much of a scene for that. I wasn't really exposed to it. I kind of got into that world through playing Magic, which was like, hey, there's a bunch of other nerds around you who like weird nerdy stuff, so that was cool. And then I knew a couple of people who played D&D, so asked around. This would have been probably like 7 years ago. And I don't know, I watched Acquisitions Incorporated, had no idea what the hell was going on. And it was just like, that seems fun. I don't understand what's happening, but it seems cool. And then I met one person who was a friend of a friend at a house party and just said, hey, you play D&D, right? And he was like, yeah. I was like, how do I do that? And he was like, oh, I think my DM's in the other room. Let me go get him out here. So this guy named Paul came out, who ended up becoming one of my best friends, and he was like, oh yeah, just come over on Sunday, we'll roll you up a character. I was playing 3.5, which is my first exposure to D&D, and like 40 minutes into it, I was just like, why have I never played this? Like, why is this is amazing? And 2 weeks after that, I was DMing a game for my roommates because they were like, oh, you're playing D&D? Oh, that seems fun. We should play. I was like, yeah. They're like, you should DM. You have the most experience. I was like, cool. So, yeah. Which I guess they were technically right. But yeah, no, the first campaign, total train wreck, playing 3.5 as well. That went on for a few years, but super fun. And then, yeah, I pretty much made the jump from 3.5 straight to 5th edition eventually, which only happened because a friend of ours, I think, got a bunch of the books just for Christmas or something. And he's like, oh, let's try this. And we tried it. And, of course, now that's kind of what everyone's playing. We still have all the old 3.5 character sheets. Everyone's character's like level 20 now. And we keep saying we're going to get back to it. So who knows? But, yeah, that's pretty much my history of the game.
You know what? Just to interrupt, I'll say this. So the group that I get together with twice a year, I call it the Gaming Weekend Group. It's a bunch of old college buddies. They all started playing when they were like in eighth grade. And I've only known them for like 20 years. So I'm still the new guy. but their campaign has been going since the 80s. Now you ask, like, how could that be possible? Well, they basically invented a remort system. So when they max out on levels in any game system, they just like, they're reborn into a new body with yeah. their consciousness. So it's almost like an MMO in a sense.
That's
but cool. That's how we were able to play through 3rd, 3.5, then Pathfinder, then 4th, then 5th. And it actually works. So to anybody playing in a long-running campaign who's like, ah, what do we do when we hit level 20? Just reset. Mm-hmm. And it'll still be fun, I promise.
I always tried to include, like in the story, it's like 20 years later and you can play descendants of NPCs or characters from that era. And you kind of just start over and maybe they're NPCs at that point. So maybe someone's character is like if it's a human, is now an old man in the new campaign and they can maybe actually becomes the quest giver and stuff like that.
Yeah, we actually, yeah. That's literally our circumstances right now. The Gaming Weekend will convene next weekend. For 4 straight days of gaming, alcohol, and meat, mostly. But yeah, that's literally what's happened is the older generation has now become NPCs, mm-hmm. and they're hugely powerful. They are influential. It's set in the Forgotten Realms, and I get to play in this. But it's cool because they've built their own lore, and I think any long running D&D group. That's one thing that you could do as well, like Wally said, is make what your other characters, make it part of canon in your world and make that something that carries on. Now, one thing that I will say you got to be careful about is that sometimes people abuse that and they make their like former character who was like 10th level into like a demigod, like, you know, slow down, let's keep it real. But, you know, there are cool ways within, you know, the reality and paradigm of your game to be able to integrate your old characters and really make it part of the fabric of the storyline, which I think is also a really cool way to do things.
I'm such a huge fan of doing that because anytime some string that was connected to a previous campaign shows up, it makes your world feel so real. People are like, oh, what's that guy up to now? I want to know. It's like, you might never find out, but they just know that this guy is still out there doing something, but like, you know, I find stuff like that really fascinating.
Well, and even with like the D&D with high school students, you know, when kids graduate, it's hard to get them to come back from college to play in a D&D game. So what I've ended up doing is making their characters into NPCs, and they're not super powerful and they're not immortal and they can be killed, but it really makes the storylines kind of connect and the fans love it. Like my fans love when they see these characters from season 1 or season 2 popping up in season 4 and having yeah. some impact in the storyline. And even when they're almost killed, it's kind of like a cool thing.
Absolutely. What about you there, Caleb?
So, I was always tangentially like just sort of near D&D. Like, I programmed, like, basically what amounted to be, like, role-playing games on in BASIC and Pascal. And when I was in
Pascal,
I read all, like, the Greyhawk books. And but, like, I came from a very, like incredibly rural, like, backwoods area where, like, there was no D&D at all, period. Like, the nearest Walmart was, like, over an hour away from, like, where we lived. And that was, like, the biggest store ever. Mm-hmm. And, like, there just was nothing. So it wasn't until, like, well after college that I was able to play Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 2nd Edition, which is amazing. And Bill Allen might sit here and claim that flipping a coin can be fascinating, but, sir, I don't know if you're aware of the beauty of the economics and trading rules in place in Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. But I don't know how flipping a coin could possibly compare to that, sir.
Well, I will say that while I truly believe that I could run a narrative with no dice at all.
Oh yeah.
I do respect the crunchiness, if you will, of certain gaming systems and their abilities to simulate things.
Yeah.
Very, very realistically. And we all have to remember that, you know, D&D was started by wargamers. These were people who were into precision. They were into historical, you know, accuracy. So they were very interested in, you know, math and measurements and charts and tables and you know, making things less about rolling a die and more about, you know, how many factors did you consider in your strategy?
Yes.
And that I do have a huge appreciation for. In fact, my mentor, the person who taught me D&D originally, Jeff Allen, invented a game called Empires, Legions, and Tyrants, which I dare say might have been the most complicated game ever, which is why we only played one full round of it. But it took into account everything, dude. Economy, politics, government, agricultural factors, climate,
mm-hmm.
and its impact on agricultural, like everything. It was less of a role-playing game and more of like it was almost like Civ before mm-hmm. Sid Meier's invented Civ. It was Civ on pencil and paper.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do appreciate that. I have a respect for it. I don't prefer it, but I have a respect for it.
Yeah. And just to be a serious answer, like, you know, Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, you can play it as complex or as simply as you need to in the moment. And I think that's the flexibility there is, like, super important. And I think that's something that 5e has in common. I went through a hellish period of my life that I don't want to reflect on, where I briefly was a player in a 4E game. And that was not very fun. I'm sure if you completely ignore half of the rules in that game edition, then you can make that a fast-moving game. But, you know, I don't know. It was not to my liking. But you know, 5e was great. There was a lot of things that I feel that it has in common with, you know, well, not really in common, but it's, like I said, the flexibility there is there in terms of, you know, so I've been doing mostly 5e for the last couple of years.
Very nice. I'm going to chime in real quick and, to wrap this up here. I've actually been playing, I was in the fifth grade, 1983. Bill, I might be just a little bit older than you, I'm trying to think. I was doing the math on your stuff there. So just by a fraction, though. But anyway, 1983, somebody introduces me to it in the fifth grade. We had a 30-minute lunch hour. He created me a character. We got into a really quick story where there's this floating dagger talking to me. The bell rang. We went back to class. The next day, he moved away. It was 1 year later before I actually – and I was living in a very, 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 very small town out west in Utah. And it was 1 year later where I found – the Red Box Basic D&D set at a KB Toys in Salt Lake City, Utah. And I bought that, and it was absolutely amazing. And the rest was history after that. But
I wait, hold on, Wally. Hold on. Shoot. Do you still have the Red Box?
Oh,
Oh, shit.
He's opening up the safe.
Oh, come on. I have red. I have green.
Ah, lovely.
I've got all of it right here at my fingertips. And there's not a I mean, these things are barely holding on. Barely holding on. But I do have to say, though, I did start picking up the first edition stuff, and I kind of, after I started getting into it, I nixed the elf and the dwarf and stuff and included the classes and the races from first edition. So I mixed a lot of my stuff, and I did that probably all the way up until about 2001 when I hung up the hat and went on to support my kids and everything else and took a 15-year layoff from D&D. And then in 2016... came back in. I started watching the Acquisitions Incorporated, and it was, I mean, Chris Perkins, if you're, you know, he's not listening, but Chris Perkins pulled me back into this hobby. That's for sure. I watched how he played the Acquisitions Incorporated game, and I was just like, holy smokes, this is amazing. And I just, and for the first time too, I looked around and just like, wait a minute, everybody's okay with D&D? I don't have to hide the fact that I'm watching this. I just like, wait, how many views is this? Holy smokes. And then it did last about 6 months in Pathfinder, about gave up again. And then 5th edition, I people turned me on to that, and it's been – I love it. It's absolutely amazing.
It's funny that you mentioned having to hide it. So I know this isn't a topic, but for those of us who played back in the day, there was definitely a social stigma. There were two social stigma eras. Number one was if you played D&D, you were a nerd. So – I like my playing of role-playing games was about as closeted as you could be, like next to being gay in the 80s. Like I would never have admitted that I played games outside of my immediate circle of gaming friends. Like I had girlfriends in high schools who didn't even know. They're like, what are you, why aren't you available Friday night? I was like, I have things to do. Like I had to hide it, you know? Mm-hmm. But then there's also the Satanic Panic, which, you know, a lot of people hear about and read about, but I lived through it, and I'm sure Wally did too. But, like, even in an urban area like Chicago, like, it was a real thing. Like, parents were, like, all freaked out by it. And I remember we took a trip to Florida to go see my older sister, and I had my Player's Handbook and Monster Manual. And, like, I was, you know, I had them out reading. And the next morning I woke up and I couldn't find my backpack. And I was like, where's all my stuff? And my sister's like, oh, my husband put it out on the patio because he says that it's like demonic.
Not in this house.
I'm not even joking, dude. Like, and just to give you some context, my father was a college teacher, but prior to that, he was a priest. And he never had a problem with me playing D&D because he knew that that idea of it being satanic was absolutely ludicrous. And he also knew how engaging it was for me. And I constantly asked him questions about like ancient Greece and mythology and religions and stuff. And it, you know, he saw that it helped me become kind of inquisitive and interested. And, you know, he never had a problem with it. But yet here's, you know, my brother-in-law at the time, who just as a side note was a total asshole anyway. But, you know, putting my D&D books out on the patio, I was like, what the – even when I was like 12, I was like, what the fuck, man? But, yeah, that was – that the satanic
– I just imagine 12-year-old Bill wearing sunglasses just glaring at some what the fuck, man?
It was a weird time. But, you know, I think it was somewhere in the 90s where it was okay. It was okay to admit that you played role-playing games – and, you know, especially in college and in your 20s, there were a lot of people, you know, playing D&D and a lot of other games, and the White Wolf vampire games were popular back then and stuff. Yeah. But
I want to make a note here. Where I came from, it was not okay. The Satanic Panic stayed around for the late 80s, early 90s, until basically I went to college. And there was a huge stigma. And I don't remember when this happened, but it was when I was relatively, like, young. Like, I wasn't like a high schooler, but some teacher told me this story about how some teenager was playing D&D and then like went off into the woods and sacrificed a small child because of it. And it wasn't until last month I was doing I was editing a supercut of the Satanic Panic for my channel. And I found a video from like, that was basically that scenario. So I had looked it up. I never found this. This never happened. But in this video that was produced, I believe, I don't know. I got the link someplace. But in the video that was produced, like, that's exactly what happens. Like, this guy was playing D&D. He failed a saving roll, and the dungeon master was like, "Well, you can succeed if you pay in blood." And that's the scenario that played out. Like, this kid in the video literally went and sacrificed a small child so he could win at D&D.
I mean,
that's commitment, folks.
As much as demanding blood sacrifices from your players is a tremendous power move, I have to say I've never experienced anything akin to that.
Yeah.
Wow.
You got to be serious.
In fifth edition, if it was a fifth edition game and somebody is willing to make a blood sacrifice, I might give them advantage on a couple rolls.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know,
I just like, just get me a beer instead. I mean, I don't go through all that. I'll even give you inspiration. You give me a cold brew out of the fridge, we're good to go.
Yeah.
To contrast that with my experience, ever since I started playing D&D, almost every person I've told has said, "That's cool. Either I also play or I would like to try playing." And to the point where my mom, who is like a very devout Christian woman, was like, "Oh, we should play sometime." So I organized a session with her and another guy who I played in the game with and his parents who were visiting as well. So we had like a parents D&D session. Wow. She rolled a lawful evil drow paladin. And I was like, "This is amazing. Like, where have you been?" And she was like looking in the book and she was like, "I want to play this one. She looks like a badass. I want to kill some people." I was like, "Oh my God, that's mom." Amazing. Like, so that was cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely a sign of the times for sure that we're in the end days, I think.
Yeah.
Moms are playing D&D. Everything's going crazy. Yes.
I think that's great. And I'll tell you that... Xander Jenneret did a video, I don't know if you guys saw it, where he went back home to Wisconsin and played D&D with his mom and a bunch of people. And we were kind of like peripherally involved with that, advising them on the production and stuff. And I think that's gold, man. Good for you. Good for you, because I truly believe anybody of any age, kids, adults, senior citizens, you know, the thing is, and I say this all the time, but we live in a world where we're connected to screens. Right now, all four of us are connected to each other by screens. Mm-hmm. The reality is that when you get together around a table with people and you share in this interactive, you know, collaborative storytelling, there is nothing better, except maybe seeing like the Allman Brothers live. But like, there's nothing better than that.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. I was running a game this weekend and, you know, when the Tyrannosaurus went through the portal, I don't think that moment would have been as amazing if I wasn't there sitting around with a bunch of people in person.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow, crazy. Yeah, I'm just going to end that subject there by saying I was very lucky that I was in a very rural town when I first started playing D. In fact, pretty much all through high school and stuff. I did have to hide it in school, which was very easy for me because I was a quiet, shy kid anyway. But as far as my parents go, it was just me, my brother, my dad. And my brother, who's not a nerd whatsoever. In fact, he you know, he's my younger brother and calls me nerd all the time. But he was always my favorite player character. I built, you know, it was just me and him a lot of the times. And I built all these worlds and all these stories around him. And my dad, he never cared about it. In the 80s, he didn't buy into all that stuff or whatever. He, you know, but he did every once in a while be like, "Hey, can't you just go outside and play for a little bit?" I'm like, "Yeah, Dad, we'll do that." And we took all the D&D books outside and played outside. So, yeah, but what a contrast. And I am super, like Josiah's story there, I am super glad to hear that. I mean, you don't have to hide that you like something like that. In fact, that it's popular and stuff like that. 16-year-old me never would have believed that. That's for sure. So very cool. Let's move on. And I'm going to ask you guys right now, because we may run a little bit over time. Are you guys cool with that? Or
yeah.
Okay. We start getting close to time, let me know, and I'll wrap things up. But I wanted to base these next four questions off of our channels. And so we'll start this one with Josiah, and that is, what is your favorite obscure monster from D&D history?
You know, that's something that, like, it changes a lot, because sometimes I'll just find something like, oh, this is so stupid. Like, why does this exist? I love it. Right now, I think my favorite, I guess, obscure monster, and I feel like the definition of obscurity is different to some, because to me, there's a lot of monsters that, like, are from the AD&D days that I've never seen a reprint, that I'm like, oh, this is weird, I've never heard about this. And for people who are there, obviously, it's not obscure, but I don't know, for me, I really like the Palimpsest, which is a monster that is literally just like an arcane scroll that has gained sentience because it's just been rolled up on a shelf for like 1,000 years and the magic has just seeped into the parchment itself. And it tries to eat people, as many things back in those days did. And it'll suck someone into the scroll and they'll become like an inky version of themselves that becomes part of the scroll. And then it kind of gains abilities to cast spells and stuff based on the person it has consumed. And that was one of the monsters I did a video on.
I think everybody watched that one, yeah.
Yeah, I know, that was kind of funny, but the, I can't think of his name off the top of my head now, but the guy who basically created that monster in that issue of Dragon Magazine, like, tweeted at me, and he was like, I cannot believe there's another person on the face of this earth that is, like, talking about this in 2019. And I was like, to be honest, if you haven't heard of this, literally just look up the artwork. It's a Palimpsest. And it's like a scroll and a guy from like the shoulders up being dragged into it. And the look on his face is horror only expressible by someone being consumed by a piece of paper. So that definitely right now anyways, I would say is the number one kind of weird one that I just have a soft spot for.
Has anybody else heard of that monster or no? Because I haven't. No?
I've heard of something similar, but not the paper thing.
Yep, obscurity at its best. Nice. What about you there, Caleb?
Another Dragon Magazine thing. He reminded me of it. The mutant deer, the Chessex, the fear deer.
The fear deer.
Which is a normal stat block for a deer, but its horns contain a powerful poison, where if it pricks you, then you are just under the effect of like this horrific terror, and you have to run away from the deer. So I've used that a lot. Yeah,
that sounds perfect for like a Christmas one shot or something.
Oh yeah.
What about you, Bill?
Okay, so as a DM or a player,
whichever you'd like.
I've been fascinated with the Neo Otioph. It's like the garbage pit creature monster. Yeah. It lives in piles of refuse. I don't know why. I just like the illustrations.
Can that one talk as well?
It might be able to. I've never used it as a DM. And I don't know if I've ever encountered it as a player.
Yeah, the bizarre thing about the original Trash Monster is that it can actually talk, which is bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, so... But as a DM, it's I don't have a proper answer to that question because I end up creating a lot of my own monsters in my original world. Part of that stemmed from years of playing with people who knew every monster in every book and every magazine. So I started having to make up monsters of my own. So I created a lot of original monsters. If I had to say a monster from canon, I would say the human. Okay. And I don't mean to be trite.
No, I get you.
Here's why. Because, you know, you could throw a monster and whether the players know the stat block or not, you know, if you describe a monster effectively as a DM, they might be able to figure out ways of dealing with it. But I think that perhaps the most threatening and sinister monsters are the ones that people have the least expectations for in terms of how to deal with it. And I think the human can be the most dangerous monster of all.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it could be anything.
That's one of the most unpredictable, for sure.
And it's always great to have, like I do the whole cheap miniatures thing, and like, you know, Dreamblade miniatures, where you just find these bizarre miniatures, and you just you stat block it out, like, based on, like, you know, this is what it actually looks like, and what can that actually do.
That's a great exercise. I like that idea. That's a really good exercise. Just pick up a few things from a game or a thrift store or whatever, and they're like, what is this?
Well, and like the Mage Knight miniatures, a lot of people, you know, will sell. So I picked up a lot of, I don't know, 200 Mage Knight minis for some stupid cheap price. And a lot of them, you know, blend with D&D, but a lot of them don't. They're just some weird mini. And I'm like, okay, this is going to be a bone demon thing that's not going to match up to anything. And I just write up a stat block for it. So, yeah, I agree. Sometimes just making up something to kind of surprise your players is often the best monster.
There was a Horror Clicks miniature, which is the and it was, I believe its name was the Spine Sucker, and it's basically like a skeleton with this giant beak coming out of its mouth, and I made up what is possibly one of my favorite creations for just this horrific monster based on that I used in my games. So
yeah, for sure.
Cool. Back in the day when those were so cheap, even Horror Clicks are now going up in price. Everything is. Oh,
is Mage Knight going up in price too?
Mage Knight's actually pretty.
Still pretty low.
It's not as good as it was, but it's not that bad. You can definitely find, if you're looking to invest in a big lot, like Bill said, you can definitely find really good prices on the larger lots.
Now, was it one of your videos that I watched where you actually take it off of like the spin dial and put it on other things? Have you done that with the Mage Knights or no?
I believe you're thinking of somebody else's video, and okay. I know the video you're talking about, but I don't think I've actually shown. Maybe I have. I think I did that for Dreamblade where I showed taking it off, but no, somebody else did a very good video where they show how to take them off the bases and rebase them. So
Very cool. And then I'll wrap this up here. So my favorite obscure monster, and I actually probably sent this to Josiah probably about a year ago, is the Oblivax Memory Moss.
Oh yeah.
And it's just it's one of my favorite things. It has like one hit point, and it looks just like ordinary moss. And a character will come up, and they have to make a saving throw, or it steals their memories for the last 24 hours. And if there's spells included in those memories, then it gets to cast the spells. And just one of my all-time favorites just to include in. You're getting attacked by 15 orcs. Oh, by the way, there's all this kind of weird moss that's laying around the, the area. And then all of a sudden, the spellcaster's minds are getting sucked out. But definitely one of my favorite ones. And like I said, Josiah's got a really good tutorial on that creature there.
I did it, when you said that to me, I did a video on it like a week later, and I think I like that creature so much because not only is it like neat in combat with stealing the spells and stuff, there are so many uses for something that does that outside of combat. Like if you're like an assassin of some kind, you plant that in someone's room and they just wake up and have no memory of a day. Like, I don't know why you'd want to do that, but I'm sure there's some situation that you could create where that would be a huge benefit, right?
Absolutely. Oh, there we go. We're gonna go samesies on the Monster Manual 2 with Oblivax in it. Actually, I've thought about that and using it in a puzzle where it's kind of just a Groundhog Day until you figure out the puzzle. And it's because at the end, there's an Oblivax memory moss. And if you fail, it steals your memories. You go back to the beginning. Great discussion on that. And again, that question was centered on the Dungeon Dad channel with obscure monsters. So the next one is centered more on the Blanco channel. And do you collect D&D miniatures? Do you have a favorite, a prized possession, or a story? And Caleb, we'll go ahead and start with you.
I do have a lot of favorite miniatures. I think probably my favorite line is the Chainmail Pewter line that Wizards of the Coast did back in the day. But my favorite miniature is definitely my own little sculpted owlbear miniature that I made. That was my own little miniature that I just, you know, was having a rough time of it. And I just took a day just to sculpt this dumb little miniature, which turned out to be just a fun little guy. So I also have like a bizarrely, I have like a lot of weirdo stuff from the days where I would just buy big eBay lots. Mm-hmm. The video game Dark Legacy, Gauntlet Dark Legacy. There was supposed to be a series of miniatures from Reaper. They never got released. So one of them that I have is the Jester miniature, which was never actually officially released as a miniature. That was a developer gift to the people that made the games. Really and cool. I have that one. So that's probably like the, and I have a lot of miniatures that I'm really proud of that I both sculpted and painted and just found and made. But miniatures are, you know, I think they're useful in certain aspects of the game in terms of like tactical stuff and just, you know, so people understand what's going on. But
I wish there was I know there's like Roll 20 and Fantasy Grounds and stuff like that, but I prefer to do Theater of the Mind when I'm playing online. But I do miss the home games where I break out my miniatures. I like collect miniatures, and I don't even have a home game right now. Just like, oh, that's cool. I want this. You know, I went to Gen Con. I come back with all these miniatures and, you know, put them away in their little piles, and I don't even get to use them. I just like enjoy having them. What about you, Bill? I seen you go and get something. What you got?
Well, you remember that I mentioned my midlife crisis where I spent a lot of money on Dwarven Forge.
Yes.
It might have gone also into other things.
Uh-oh.
So when I was growing up playing D&D, I was never the kid who had minis. Everybody else had minis. I never had minis. I had a couple sets. I never got into painting minis. So when I was older, I got all the minis. I bought a Craigslist. I went on Craigslist. I found a guy who was selling his collection of original, like, 80s 25 and 28 millimeter pewter minis. A lot of them were painted. I still have a bunch that are unpainted, and there was a ton that weren't even opened that were still in the package.
Nice.
And then I went and bought a bunch of Mage Knight minis just for practical play. I bought, I think, pretty much every Dwarven Forge set of minis that they make. And then when we started doing D&D with high school students, a lot of the fans would just send us minis.
That's awesome.
And one of my patrons, DOD Spec Ops, is also an excellent painter. So we started getting custom minis for the high school students that were playing in the games that were incredibly well painted, like way better than I could ever do. And as a surprise gift at the end of season 3, the students bought a mini and had DOD Spec Ops paint it and surprised me with it. And it's literally me. It's like a bald guy with like my mustache. And he's like reading over like a magical poem. The one that I went and grabbed, though, that I wanted to show everybody was, this is Gary Gygax as a Solar, an angel. And I do have the wings. They're in the package. But he's unpainted because I don't have the skills to paint him. But I got this at GaryCon 10, and I'm very glad that I did because he's amazing. And towards the end of summer, I was fortunate enough to play in an Extra Life game at the Gygax house in Lake Geneva. So it was basically like playing D&D in Mecca.
Wow.
And it was an experience. I'll say that. And we were fortunate enough to have Alex Gygax, Gary's youngest son, and Mike Gygax, his grandson, playing with us. So I feel like painting minis for me is stressful, but I at the same time I like doing it. I just don't have enough time to paint everything.
Yeah.
But I will definitely say that as somebody who grew up playing Theater of the Mind because I didn't own a lot of minis, it's really nice having minis and terrain now because I think it helps create kind of more of an immersive environment when you have a home game to play with.
Absolutely. Wow. Yeah, that's one heck of a treasure, that's for sure.
That's super cool, yeah.
Are you ever going to get it painted if somebody painted it for you, or are you just going to leave it unpainted? Just kind of curious.
You know what? I've thought about both options. Mm-hmm. You know, there was part of me that thought maybe I leave it unpainted, and then I sell it to somebody down the line. And then I was like, no, why would I do that? I'm like, you know,
Right.
I bought this for a reason, and I want to be able to implement it. And so I think this actually might end up being a commission where I send it to DoD Spec Ops to do, because his skills are just far superior to mine. And I know my limits. I do have some limits. So I think that might be worth commissioning.
Nice. What do you have for us, Josiah?
Yeah, I mean, I do use minis. My collection isn't massive, but I mean, it's big enough that I have like 3 boxes that are unpainted that I've just been meaning to get to. I agree that painting minis is like stressful, but only when I feel like it's stressful when it's one I know I'm going to need to use like soon. Like when I started the most recent campaign I'm doing, the first mini I painted was the final boss. So I was like, I just want this to be done. So I don't even have to think about it, because I know what I'm like, and I know it would be like the night before game time, and I'd be like, ah, shit, like I have this huge bitch ready to paint, whatever. But yeah, no, I do really like using minis. I think it's a lot of fun. And I don't know, something I often get to do is a lot of my players, they don't have their own collections, but I'll let them like pick out a mini or I'll buy one for them or whatever, and I get them to paint it. We'll do it at the beginning of a campaign. That's kind of our session zero ritual whenever we start a new game. Everyone will roll up their characters, and then everyone will paint their own minis and stuff, and it's just cool. I do like doing it a lot. The one miniature I own, which is downstairs somewhere, but the one miniature I own that I think is probably my favorite, I haven't actually gotten to use yet, but it is the Reaper minis. It's the Colossal Skeleton. It's huge. Oh, it's wow. Like this tall. It's massive, and I don't even know what I'm going to use it for. But I just keep it in view whenever we play D&D. Like, it will just be on the shelf behind the area where I'm at, where I keep a lot of the other miniatures. So every time I go to reach, I'll, like, reach for that one. And then, like, look, and people just be like, what? I'm like, I don't know, I'm just kidding. Like, grab this one instead. And I'm just, like, living for the moment. This has been happening for, like, 3 years now. I'm just living for the moment where I get to reach up and grab it and actually take it. And everyone's like, oh, that's funny, that's funny. And then I'm like... No, it's happening, guys. It's like full initiative. Here we go. You're like, oh, shit.
It's like on Stranger Things, Demigorgon.
Yeah, exactly.
So I use a lot of miniatures in my puzzle videos, and if you go through like puzzle video number one and then look at today, I've really started investing a lot more in terrain, which is fun. I'm not where I want to be yet, but I am getting there. But I always refer back to the Raal Partha and the metal miniatures is the ones that I really like to use in my videos. But I do have to say probably my most treasured possession, and I'm going to share my screen here and show this to you guys. And this comes from watching Blanco's channel. And he's showing me all of these. He's going there and he's like picking up all this stuff from Goodwill and stuff. I'm just like, I just want you to know that like for a month straight, all my lunches were spent going to the Goodwills and looking through stuff and finding things. But this is probably my most prized possession. And in the background of my videos, when I do my introductions, you will actually see this here.
Nice.
And what this is this is a Super Bowl 52 cabinet. It was meant for NFL Super Bowl shot glasses for each of the winning teams for like 50. I think it has, if you can look behind the stone giant Efreet there, there's actually a Super Bowl 52 or Super Bowl 51 logo or something like that. And yeah. I got this thing for $8.
Yeah, no, that's... That is one of the best display cases, because I've actually been trying to find a shot glass display case like that, but that one looks really awesome.
It is absolutely amazing, and I just like and I like all of my travels at Goodwill and stuff. I was just like, I finally found this, and I was just super excited about it. Now it's like every video I have, it's in the background and showcasing a few things there.
That's awesome. That's like perfect.
Yeah, it was pretty stoked. My wife rolled her eyes, but it was pretty cool. All right. Okay, we lost the video on two guys there. Let's see here. Let's go ahead and I want to at least get all of us in here. So question number 7. Bill, I think you're still with us. Maybe? He might be back in just a second. So let's come back to that one, because that one's more sure. geared around him there. So this one will be more geared around my channel then. And what is or what was one of your favorite puzzles that you may or may not have used in a game? And how about we start with Josiah there?
Sure, yeah. I'm trying to remember how this puzzle worked in my head now, because it took me a while to like put this together. But essentially, this puzzle was, the end goal here was to open up a portal to get into the next area. This was during like a Halloween one shot. So it was very much just like, we're in a puzzle dungeon. This is what's happening. Like, there wasn't a whole lot of pomp and circumstance. I believe they were trying to find a way to undo a curse that had turned everyone in a town into a house hunter mimic. So the entire population was turned into houses.
Cow.
Which was pretty funny, yeah. So, like, the kids were all, like, little outhouses and, like, sheds and stuff. And, like, the mayor of the town turned into, like, the town hall and stuff. But anyways, they were trying to get to this monster. I believe it was a hag who would cast a curse to get her to undo it or defeat her or whatever. And they're in this room, and basically there was just two ropes that were, like, 60 feet long. And you had to get them to both. You had to basically jump into the portal at exactly like a 30-second increment, and they were able to do a lot of calculations that involved like burning the ropes and seeing how long they would burn for and stuff. And the solution was to ultimately burn one of the ropes halfway, and then at that point burn the other two ropes from both ends, and that would be help allow you to like time it out to exactly the time that you needed.
Nice.
And that was my favorite, just because it was so complicated, and I think we sat there for about half an hour. And but it wasn't like frustratingly complicated. Like people were like, "Oh, let's do this, let's do this, let's do this." And my one friend who was playing is a math student, and he was silent for like the entire time, just like making notes. And then he just like slammed his book down. He's like, "I figured it out." He's like, "This is what we have to do," and just like listened. And everyone was like, "Cool." And then they did it, and it worked. And yeah, it was good. It was a
that's
good
awesome
for sure.
Yeah, that's one I haven't heard before. That's a good one. I like it. What about you there, Caleb?
I gotta say there was a very complex puzzle that it was kind of like a death trap type thing. And it had to do with a mural that was like built on the wall itself. And there was just this cryptic note that said, you know, honor the king before you partake in his flora and fauna. And there was different things that they basically had to press. And but basically, like, the room is sealed off by this giant metal door. And so a bunch of things are triggered all at once, where the metal door slams down. The room starts filling with poison. A secret door opens up. And this giant mechanical foo dog enters the room and just starts attacking people. And so people think, oh, okay, so they kill the foo dog. Usually, but then they're like, oh, wait, the room's still filling up with poison. So it's just this thing where they can approach it from different ways. The last group that went through that puzzle actually solved it amazingly well, where they saw the door happening. So they propped the door open, and so it couldn't shut. And then when the foo dog came out, they just grabbed what they needed, ran out of the room, and slammed the door behind them. And just avoided having to fight the mechanical dog. Wow. And it was really great. And I don't think a single, because it's a very complex puzzle to solve it. Basically, you just have to press stuff on the mural in a certain way. Mm-hmm. But it's a very interesting thing to see how like people approach it in a very different way. One people just saw the secret door and it's like, oh, a secret door. I'm going to trigger this because secret doors always mean good stuff.
Right. Yeah. But
that group managed to fight the food dog before the room got sealed with the poison.
Yeah.
So they actually, you know, so it's you know, it's an interesting thing to see how people approach it.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing with puzzles in D&D is too, is you need to make them easy, because we look at them from one perspective, but all of your players are going to look at them from another perspective, and what they're going to come up with is usually not the answer.
It's amazing.
Yeah,
I was dealing with a German high school student where I had the it was a fancy version of the famous logic puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
The two guards puzzle. Okay. Which is at in the end it's basically a logic puzzle at the end of the day,
right?
And he solved that within like literally 3 seconds. Oh, it's a it's an issue where it can only be this answer. Right. See, he solved it immediately. There was two guys my age that I was running a game for, and they just could not figure it out. So yeah, it puzzles are interesting how they can be either super easy or super hard depending how the players play. But I, you know, I always like to give a little leeway in case the players come up with a creative solution that I didn't see coming. Yeah. Yep.
I've definitely made puzzles before that don't have a predetermined solution. And just when the players come up with something that I'm like, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. They just have gotten through it. Because people will come up with things that are like so far beyond anything you even considered. You're like, that actually does make sense. And that
like the foo dog thing that I came up with, the goal of that trap is to kill the players. There's no predetermined, oh, this is how the players got out of that. The entire goal of that room is for everybody to die who goes in that room and triggers the traps. But like, and then in every single group, I think only one group got wiped out by that. But all the other groups solved it in like wildly different ways. Yeah. Wildly different ways.
That's crazy. And when I do, I have run some one-shot puzzle adventures before, and I've ran them like 2, 3, 4 times for different groups. And just watching the interactions and how each group solves it and comes up and when they're brainstorming, thinking about that stuff, it's just, it's got to be one of my favorite parts about the game. And yeah, absolutely amazing. Bill, welcome back. What do you have for us as far as puzzles?
I mean, I've run puzzles, you know, over the years that required different kind of logic steps. Some that involved, you know, kind of like math tricks. Some that involved basic science, you know, like leverage things. But I think more recently with fifth edition, I try to come up with puzzles that integrate each character's lore or the potential, you know. So if somebody's really good at arcana, somebody's good at history, somebody's good at religion, you know, some of those, I think in a lot of D&D campaigns, people often look past the knowledge-based proficiencies. And I like to actually integrate that so that if the player asks a question about the significance of these symbols and do they have any religious symbolism, that kind of stuff, and they successfully make their religion check, then I kind of will feed them some clues so that in that way, it's integrating some of the character's abilities to kind of facilitate solving the puzzle without just giving the whole thing away.
Right.
And that has worked. That model, I guess, I've been kind of playtesting both in home games and in D&D with high school students, and then in a few of the convention games that I've run. And I think it just kind of it pulls people in, and it gives them a chance to see that their characters' choices have made some difference.
Yeah.
And even some of the social skills, like I've had puzzles where there's a sentient animated object or like a gargoyle or something who will actually answer questions depending on how they're phrased. And sometimes the players with the higher social stats have an opportunity then to use either persuasion or deception, you know, to kind of have some better grasp of how to solve the puzzle.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. As much as an old school person I am that believes that puzzles are best solved using player knowledge, I love allowing intelligence checks or, you know, like you said, with the charisma based skills, you know, allowing, you know, them to persuade or whatever else. I think that's a wonderful inclusion. And in fact, that's probably what I try to do with a lot of them. Is once they get into an area, is allow them to make some checks. You know, does this have religious significance? Does this, you know, maybe they learned about this in wizard school or whatnot. So,
And I don't like. I will say though, just to clarify, I don't like a puzzle that's solved with just a roll of the die. Like it's not like one check is going to solve the puzzle, but I tend to use it more as like, okay, if you succeed, first of all, if the player had the capacity to inquire about that and how they could use their specific knowledge, I tend to use it more as just an opportunity to give a clue versus mm-hmm. just like, okay, you made the die roll and you're, you know, you succeed, the trap unlocks. Yeah. So it's more of a way to kind of integrate a little bit of the mechanics and the role playing aspect, but not necessarily give away the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah. And one of the things that I was asked a while back was players just using spells to solve puzzles without anything. And in my games, you know, my players kind of know that they're going to need to use their spell slots to make sure they don't die in combat, or to use those spell slots to create a situation where they're going to be able to have an area that's going to be somewhat safe for them to rest in. So if they want to use the spell slots to solve the puzzles, I let my players do whatever they want. But after a while, they start to realize it's like, okay, we're in a very dangerous area right now. If we waste all our spell slots to, we should probably figure out a way to do this without expending resources that we can otherwise be using elsewhere. But I mean, some people are just going to do that, and you got to let the players do what they want to do. Yeah. But I also use, sometimes I just have, you know, anti-magic runes, just, yeah. you know, inscribed hundreds of them everywhere. So yeah. sometimes magic doesn't work.
Yeah, all of my doors are sealed by a 357th level wizard, so, you know, not beating that. So let's back up to a question here that goes more oriented on Bill's channel here. And someone in my Discord server actually wanted to know that what tips would you have for getting a D&D program started in a high school or a community? And for those of you that don't know, Bill has a very popular video series entitled D&D with high school students. I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, so I mean, I think first and foremost, if you can partner with an existing entity, that's a great leg up. So if you have a friendly local game store, that's a great opportunity, or your public library, or sometime even, you know, the park district. If you're a staff member at a school and you can speak with your director of activities and kind of talk about the opportunities that role-playing games provide to a lot of times underserved communities. You know, and the funny thing is that on our show, we have kind of a mix of all sorts of kids. I get kids who are really academically gifted. I get really shy, kind of nerdy kids who already have a gaming background. I get kids who are somewhere on the autistic spectrum. Like, and I think the reality is that if you work at it, you can bring together a lot of different kinds of people into a gaming community. But I will say this, there's definitely, with every gaming table, there's a chemistry. And even if you're not doing it for live streaming, you know, if you're just playing around a table with people, there is definitely chemistry involved, and not everybody mixes with everybody, and that's okay. I think you could have different groups of people who feel more comfortable playing with each other. But, you know, in regard to kind of building a community, I think the best thing is to kind of lay out a proposal, short and sweet, that summarizes the benefits of role-playing games. The benefits of kids nowadays. I like to emphasize the fact that this generation has grown up on screens, and they need a break. They need an opportunity to get together with other human beings mm-hmm. at a table and interact. It's great for building social skills. It's fantastic for basic mathematics. It's great for encouraging reading and writing. Mm-hmm. And even on the social and emotional level, it's a fantastic way to encourage people to kind of develop empathy, to understand what other people might feel in certain circumstances, to imagine yourself in someone else's shoes. Those are all hugely valuable educational tools. And I actually just finished an interview with somebody. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, so I'll keep it brief, but there's an interview that I just completed that's going to be published soon. And really it comes down to kind of what I said about building a community. And I think now more than ever, people of different beliefs, people of different backgrounds have an opportunity to come together face to face and interact with this medium that we all know the benefit of with role-playing games, but I think there's a whole world of people that could benefit from that experience.
Very nice. Josiah, anything to add on that? Or
I mean, I feel like you just kind of knocked it out of the park, really. I mean, in my own experience, like, I obviously, Billy, have a totally different perspective on that than a lot of other people would, considering what you do. And yeah, I think that just in a general sense, I couldn't agree more. I know just when it comes to, like, friends or acquaintances who become friends through D&D, like, you learn a lot about each other and about what you care about and that kind of thing in playing D&D together, because it just opens you up in, like, a completely different way, and you ask questions that you maybe never even thought to consider before. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I think there's just a lot of value in that, both in terms of, like, getting to know other people and community and the people you're sharing your world with, but also yourself as well. Because it's like you said, like, you're literally putting yourself in your character's shoes, and you really, I don't know, you just think about a lot of things that you wouldn't normally even take the time to think about, which I think is definitely has a lot of value outside of just playing a tabletop game, right?
Mm-hmm. Caleb?
No, I think Bill said it best. I've done programs at the different public libraries I've been associated with. And, you know, it's always great to see young kids and just kind of a mix of ages just kind of play like a round of D&D and just how they approach things so differently. And I think there's always been like a real appreciation of, you know, people appreciate, oh, wow, this person and that I normally would not interact with is actually approaching this problem in a very interesting way that I probably would never do. So it's yeah, I think Bill said it best.
Absolutely. I'll finish out that topic just saying that, boy, we have come a long way from hiding my paper at my desk trying to draw out a dungeon map to what Bill has going on at a high school. And yeah. I watch your videos, and the work you're doing is absolutely amazing. Seeing these kids, I mean, and they just take it, they make it their own. It's just really, really cool to see. And I think one of the best things about having D&D in high schools and stuff is everybody does truly win at it. I mean, you're all building, creating something together that's unique. I mean, once you create this, story or you create this timeline with your characters and stuff, it's, I mean, there's nothing else like it on the earth. And I mean, these kids are, like I said, just watching the videos, it's just awesome. Awesome. So,
yeah. And for me, there's, you know, there are people who often ask, like, well, you know, aren't you concerned about, like, the trolls and stuff who comment? And I'm really not, because there are people who will comment, and they'll, you know, they'll shred somebody based on their actions in the game, or they'll, you know, and then there's a lot of people who kind of see themselves as being helpful and be like, hey, remember that you have this spell that you could do as a druid and blah, blah, blah. And I don't feel like there's a burden for me as the teacher or the DM to make sure that these kids play, quote unquote, correctly. Because I didn't play correctly. I don't know about you guys, but I didn't. I learned the hard way. Every time people ask me, like, what's your highest level character? I've died more than any character. I can't even possibly begin to tell you how many characters I've had, because I've died all the time from making stupid mistakes. But that's also how we learn. We learn by failing. And the best part about role-playing games is that you could fucking die and it's just a game.
You say that my D&D character died.
Yeah.
I say that your D&D character never lived.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, so I love being in the position to let newbies make mistakes. I love being in the position to see them learn from their mistakes and then grow. Mm-hmm. The most rewarding thing is, you know, towards the middle or the end of a season, when a kid actually figures out what they could do with this character.
Yeah.
Or when they start to care about an NPC, and when they start to realize that they were kind of being murder hobos. You know, yeah. I mean, that's the best. And you know, of course, it's very rewarding after they graduate too. And I get an email or a message that says, "Hey, I just met these kids in college that also play in D&D. I'm joining their group." And I'm like, "Yes, yes, yes."
Awesome. And on that note, just one thing, like my wife and I noticed, I mean, we're, you know, in our upper 40s and stuff, and we've had quite a few hobbies over our years. And like one of them, for instance, was bowling. We used to be avid bowlers in our 30s and stuff. But there's not a lot of young bowlers that are taking the place of the active ones. So like, especially in our area, that's kind of a sport that's starting to die out and things. And so to see what you're doing with high school students and seeing this interaction and stuff, I mean, that is the way that we build our hobby. Is to teach it to the younger communities and to get them for a love for it. And I kicked myself in the ass for taking a 15-year break from it when I had two kids of my own and two stepkids, and I never introduced them to D&D. After I got back into it, I had one of them that did join me and did get to play a few games with me, which I'm very thankful for. But I mean, that's just obviously one thing. If we want to see D&D continue to grow and be where we want it to be, then, you know, teaching it to these young kids and giving them and passing down that love and appreciation for it, it's just so important. So
yeah, absolutely. And you know, I tell the high school kids, it doesn't matter what you play. You know, if you play Call of Duty, if you play Assassin's Creed, any of these games, I say no matter how good the graphics get, no matter how open world and sandbox these games become, they will never beat what you can imagine in your mind. They will never be that good. And I can tell definitively the moment when these kids realize that there's truly nothing limiting them in a role-playing game. And it's that click moment, that light bulb moment where they realize that. And it's solid gold. And I'm not bagging on video games. I love video games. I think they're great. My kids play them. I still play them. I suck. But, but you know, I mean, the reality is that, like, our imaginations are greater than any program, greater than any virtual reality. And there's no way that the combined forces of a table full of people could be lesser than code. I mean, it's just there's nothing like that storytelling. It's a tradition that's existed through all of mankind. And, you know, I feel in a large part like my role now has become that of an evangelist. Like I want people to experience the opportunity to play role playing games. I don't even care what game it is. Just play. Just get together with people because we need that. Our souls need it.
Well said. Well said. Last question, because I've kept you guys a half an hour too late already. I thought this one was fun. This is one Josiah submitted here, and then we'll wrap it up right after this. And this is just coming from a player standpoint. What is your favorite character class? And Josiah, go ahead and start us off with that, and this will wrap it up for us.
Okay, I'm kind of torn between two classes, but because there's no sense in doing this if I don't follow the rules, I will pick one. I think Paladin is probably my favorite D&D class and always has been. And I think that's just because that was what I started with, so I have a fond memory of that for sure. But also, I don't know, I like classes that come attached with some type of implication. I mean, you can kind of work around that as you want, but the Paladin comes with this attached idea that you're part of an order, or that you're serving some kind of deity, or that you have some kind of mission or purpose or whatever. Or maybe your mission is to find what your purpose is, you know? So I really enjoy it when you have that, because with classes like the Paladin, it gives you a lot of ways for the DM to kind of tie in not just your backstory, but like a fundamental part of who your character is into the story, which I think is really cool. Also, getting a critical hit and blowing something up is super fun to me. When it's just like, oh, a 20, you say? Did I mention I'm going to smite and do this and this and this? And it's like, I just like that's hilarious. Because, again, it's a perfect blending of narrative and the class coming together, because it's like that holy warrior. You get that one, like, true devastating strike, and then you just blow up whatever demon or undead thing you're fighting. I think that's super cool. So yeah, I don't know. For those reasons, I think Paladin is probably up there for me.
Very nice. How about you, Caleb?
Traditionally, I've always loved the rogue stuff, just anything where you're using your wits to solve issues and you have a lot of like different skills you can use. Always amazing. But, you know, I've just loved just kind of like picking random classes and just seeing. I played a Forge Cleric recently, which was just so fun. Just have all the stuff you can do out of combat. So. Nice.
Very good. Bill?
Like Caleb, I would say rogue is my favorite. Because the versatility, you could make so many different kinds of rogues, the specialties, the proficiencies, all that kind of stuff. I would say though, the character I enjoyed most, started actually in Pathfinder in the long running Gaming Weekend campaign as an Oracle. I loved that character. And when we migrated from Pathfinder to fifth edition, that Oracle became a divination-based warlock, and that ended up being my highest level character, made it up to 17th level, and was just so much fun to play. But I will say this, anybody playing D&D, the reality is that there's no best race or class. You could see all the thumbnails on YouTube. It doesn't matter what all those videos say. There's no best race or class. Play all of them. Play as many as you can and die and then try another one. Because the reality is that what's most fun is trying all these different personae, the ones that Absolutely. You can be and the ones that you can't be. You know, a lot of times people say, Bill, if you were translated into D&D, what would you be? I'd probably be a bard, but that doesn't mean that I like to play bards. You don't always want to play what you are. So the most fun thing is just playing all of them.
Nice.
And yes.
When you said that, I was like picturing all the clickbait. Top five classes you should be playing in your yeah. D&D game.
Bah.
I'll finish this out there. For me, it's definitely sorcerers. I always felt like sorcerers are kind of like your superhero person. They didn't have to go out and train or nothing like that. They're kind of just gifted these abilities. And as they start as a first level character, they're starting to learn, like, you know, just like, you know, they say a few words and move their hands a little bit and a firebolt comes out or something like that. And just like, just the innocence of it. And the background as far as being able to go out and why am I this way and what made me different kind of a thing. So those have always been my favorite, but I know Josiah didn't go into two classes, but I'm going to, but I can't help it. I haven't played a lot, but you know, I did get to play a bard a couple times, and I'm actually starting to like him because I like to talk a lot and make people laugh, and that's pretty much what my bards are. I get that high charisma, and any NPCs, I'm talking to them, you know. So, but yeah, anything else on that subject? And anything else in particular, we will wrap it up if not.
The only thing I'll say is, since you said two classes, now I'll say the second one. I was going to say Warlock, actually. Literally just because I think the like meta exclamation / headcanon of Mike Merles is hilarious. I don't know if you see that interview where he talks about Warlocks. But he just said that because Warlocks haven't really been a thing in the past. It's like new to 5th edition, like making a bargain, whatever. As like a part of the class. And he just said that in his headcanon in the Forgotten Realms, the reason that they haven't existed as a class before is because people just figured out how to do that. It's like people just in the world figured out, like, wait, I don't need to go to school. I can just strike up a deal with the devil. That's a great idea. Or like a devil was like, hold on a second here. What if, like, you know, I just think that's funny. And it's, again, the same kind of thing I touched on with Alan. It's just a very much a blending of class mechanics with story potential, which I think is cool.
Very awesome. All right. I have kept you guys a very long time. My apologies for that, but this has been a fantastic discussion and super excited to talk with all of you. And hopefully everybody watching enjoyed it as well. Just a couple of quick things before I head out for the podcast. Giveaway winners from episode 2, Sandro, Zanelli, and Fowl. You have won yourself some dice, so get a hold of me. Let me know what your address is, and I will ship them to you. And for everyone else that is watching this, if you would like a chance to win a set of D&D dice, all you need to do is, after this video goes live on the channel, not in the live chat because I won't see it, but leave a comment below under the video once it is actually posted to the YouTube channel, and I will do a random drawing and announce the winners for episode 4. And of course, for those of you that have not joined the Discord channel yet, we've just hit 100 members. And if you would like to hang out with me and all kinds of cool people that know a lot of things about D&D, check out the link to the Discord channel. And speaking of links, I have a link to Bill Allen's channel, Blanco and Dungeon Dad. If you have not seen the videos of these guys, I highly encourage you, go over there, subscribe, click that notification bell. There's there's the puppet. I watch these, I watch these guys all the time, and just some great D&D content, and I appreciate everything they do. So when I wanted to do a D&D podcast or a video like this, these are the three of the four guys that I thought of. I also how to D&D with Fred Wheeler's out there too, but he could not make it tonight. So with that being said, let's do some outros there. I'll let each one of you plug your channels and whatever you like. Bill Allen, what do you got for us?
Bill Allen World. You could find me by looking up Bill Allen or the Bill Allen on all of the different social media. And I just want to say it has been a distinct pleasure having a nice conversation with you gentlemen. And I'm very grateful for being invited. And yeah, this is awesome.
Thank you. Caleb.
yeah, all my channels on Blanco, check it out. Could be trying out some new stuff, but mostly the finds video and whatnot. So check out what's going to be happening, and hopefully we'll see what's going on. I got a bunch of stuff, but unfortunately it's in the beginning plannings right now, so we'll have to see.
Awesome. Looking forward to it. And Josiah, what do you got?
Yeah, you can find my channel in the description below with the links, all that good stuff. You can find me on Twitter, Dungeon Dad. I sort of think it's Dungeon Papa on Twitter because Dungeon Dad is like some dude in Wisconsin whose account has been banned for like 10 years. But yeah, not a fake story, by the way. But if you go on my YouTube channel right now this month, I'm specifically focusing on spooky monsters, given that it is spooky month. So if you're planning a D&D one-shot or just some scary stuff going on in your games, there's lots of cool monsters to choose from there. And this Thursday on Halloween will be the latest video, which is the Nukula V, which is a skinless horse and rider merged at the waist and back from Scottish folklore.
Yeah. It's
horrendous. Nice. So yeah, you can check that out there. All kinds of stuff going on. And something else I've been working on lately as well is I just took it upon myself to try to make a new subclass for every D&D class that exists, which has been easier for some classes than others. Talking about the wizard. So if you want more class options, you think that sounds neat, if you subscribe to my Patreon for $1, you can get all the previews, and then you'll get a free copy of the PDF when that comes out in a month or so. But yeah, that's me.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks again, everyone. This is Wally DM. I appreciate everybody joining us tonight. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time. So on to the next.